From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Well, on Monday's show, we took Senator Rick Santorum's challenge to have a panel of stay-at-home moms on the show and see if they feel affirmed by society. In just a minute, we'll speak with Senator Santorum himself. But just to remind you, here's the clip of the challenge he made to George Stephanopoulos on ABC this week.
And if you don't believe that, get a panel of stay-at-home moms here on your show, and you ask them whether they feel affirmed by society.
And our first guest today is Senator Rick Santorum, the Pennsylvania Republican, who is one of the leaders of the Christian conservative wing of Congress. His new book is titled It Takes a Family, an explicit riff on Senator Hillary Clinton's old book, It Takes a Village. It Takes a Family is published by ISI. And Senator Santorum, great to have you back. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you, Brian. It's good to be back with you. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
So in that clip from ABC this week, and I'm going to play another portion of it, you start out by saying radical feminists taught women to devalue the home and overvalue the workplace, but then you ended it saying men and women. Listen to this.
And that goes for men and women. And it's wrong. It's wrong to tell that to fathers. It's wrong to tell that to mothers. And we need to value mothers and fathers spending time with their children much more than we do in America.
Now, as a father of a 7-year-old and a 12-year-old, I certainly agree with you on that. But were you arguing for more stay-at-home parenting in general or more traditional sex roles?
I think I'm arguing for more parenting from both mothers and fathers. And I say in the book, and I've said in many of the interviews, that, you know, it's different in different families. I mean, I have some very actually close friends of mine. Whose the husband stays at home and the mom works. I grew up in a family where for a good portion of my parents' career, my mother made more money than my father did. So, I mean, I don't have a hang up, but I do believe that we should have a society that understands that the most important job that mothers and fathers have is at home raising their children and nurturing that family. That job cannot be done as well by anybody else as opposed to the workplace where, you know, there are other people who can pick up that job probably just as well and do in many cases. And it's not to say people shouldn't work. Obviously, they need to work and they need to support their families. But we have to continue to understand that what's of the priorities. And I think my feeling is we have a situation of misplaced priorities in a lot of families in America.
So maybe you only have half a quarrel with what you call radical feminists, because the old feminist line is that women should have more opportunity to go into the workplace, which has happened by and large, but
right.
Also that men should do more to connect with their kids, which I think feminists say is the tougher part to accomplish.
Oh, I have no problem with men connecting more to the kids. In fact, I spend a lot of the book talking about the problem of fatherlessness, not just with fathers who abandon their children, who don't interact with their children because they never married mom and the child was born out of wedlock. Fathers never connected. I talk about fathers from divorce. There's a statistic in the book which I found rather chilling, and if I'm recalling now, and I hope this is right. But something like over 2/3 of children who are divorced, who are from divorced parents, have not seen their father in over a year's period of time, 10 years after divorce. So, you know, it's about dads who are divorced. It's about dads who never married the mother of their children, and it's also about dads who are still married who put other things ahead of their children far too often for the benefit of their children and for their family.
So is there a contradiction in much of conservative rhetoric on this, which says on the one hand that mothers have a more special bond with their children, and on the other hand, fathers need to get in there and that fatherless parenting winds up creating social problems?
I don't think it's a contradiction. I think that, what we're talking about here is that we need to have parents at home, and I think there's a recognition that in the majority of those cases, historically and today, that it's going to be more often mothers than fathers. And more often that when parents sit down and make that decision, more often mothers want to stay home more than fathers want to stay home. In fact, this, you know, when I challenged George Stephanopoulos, I had in my back pocket, had he suggested I was wrong, you know, a survey which reported that only 10% of working mothers say they would prefer to work full time. 30% say they would prefer to be home full time, and 59% said they want part time work. So, you know, that is, that obviously, if you took that survey among men, you wouldn't get those numbers. And so, you know, I'm not objecting to traditional roles, but I'm suggesting that we should be more supportive of men and women who want to have that stay-at-home time when children are at home and need their parents.
Senator Rick Santorum, my guest on WNYC. So we had that call in for stay-at-home moms, and what we got was the universal agreement with you that they feel devalued by society. But most people went way beyond radical feminism in their critique. Let me play you a soundbite of one typical stay-at-home mom who called in.
I find anything to do with children is undervalued. I mean, it's not the liberal elite. It's all of American culture, I think. The only value is money and things that make money and people who make money. The closer you come to taking care of children, the more invisible you become.
Senator, what's your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction is thank you. You know, that she's right. And it's an unfortunate situation in society that we put professional accomplishment, which if you talk to most people is not their most important thing in their life, ahead of raising and nurturing children. And that's why the call in this book is for not only government to be more supportive of families, but the popular culture. You can say it's everybody, but she said the popular culture. Let's be honest. Who are the folks who produce the TV shows, the music, the movies, the games, the popular, the news media? I mean, it is not the conservative movement out there that's producing this material. The popular culture is coming from the left, and the left is the one who are basically monetizing our roles in society. And by monetizing those roles, we devalue this very important relationship of mothers and fathers and their children.
It's funny because people on the left would probably not identify with the monetizing of everything and big business. I mean, I would say I don't know many.
I don't think it's big business. In fact, what you probably find is that big business is increasingly, in response to what their workers are demanding, being more family friendly, trying to design a workplace that allows for part-time career tracks and allows for flexible time and allows for longer leaves. That where you don't get the affirmation is, again, I mean, listen to the music that's being produced in America today, particularly the music that's being produced in places where the out-of-wedlock birth rate is the highest. Look in urban radio. Are you hearing positive messages about fathers? Are you hearing positive messages about marriage? That is not the conservative movement.
So you're probably going to get a lot of agreement across the board on that point. But I don't know many working class mothers who say radical feminists are forcing me into the workplace. I do know lots of working class mothers who say they wish they could afford to stay home.
My response to that is, look at what the federal government, just the federal government, I don't even talk about the state and local government. Look at what's happened since 1950, where we've seen a dramatic expansion of the role of government driven by the left. I won't say radical feminist, but certainly driven by the left, and that was part of the coalition of the left. And we've seen what have we seen? The average American family in 1950 paid 2% of their income to the federal government in taxes. Average American family, two parents, two kids. Today, that same average American family, average income American family, 27% of their income goes to federal government in taxes. Now, you can say that the left, is supportive of families. Well, they're taking 25% more of their income away from the American family with those two kids. And what's happened as a result? What's happened as a result is that we've had a lot of second earners in the family, in most cases women, being, in many respects, as you hear from the surveys, unwillingly giving up time with their family and going to work. Why? Because the federal government is taking more of their money.
But the left would say
finish the thought.
Go ahead.
That that the difference between 1950 and now is that the second earner earns 25% of what the first earner in the family makes, which means that the second earner, on average, is simply replacing the money in the family that the federal government has taken away.
But the left would say you're leaving out two pieces of that. One, the tax burden has shifted proportionately from business and the wealthy toward the middle class, and there's been wage stagnation, and that you're leaving out business. So people would ask, have you proposed things as a senator to require big business, for example, to give more flex time or more family leave or family wages for working parents?
Well, again, what you're suggesting is that the government needs to come in because they've created a higher burden of taxation, and now we have to force business to do what the government won't do, which is to give breaks to the American family. I don't believe it's the government's role to come in and say, okay, business, you have to pay more. So, by the way, government gets more, and maybe families get more. How about the government doing with less and enacting policies and reducing policies that I would argue have done more to hurt the family? Look at—
Why not, if the family is your prime concern, look at both things?
Well, again, I think if you look at the proposals in the book, I talk about dramatically increasing the child credit. I talk about increasing the dependent deduction for children. I talk about making the marriage penalty that's in the law right now, repeal permanent, to restructuring the tax code to be more family friendly. Now, I will tell you, there's a lot on the left who won't support that because they think it's not fair. Advantaging or targeting one particular kind of family over another. And I hear this all the time, that somehow or another that, you know, we shouldn't treat, you know, different families, all families are equal. Well, I don't believe that. I believe that mothers and fathers raising children provide something unique to our society and should be higher valued than other families.
Senator Rick Santorum, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called It Takes a Family. Are you mocking Senator Clinton with that book title?
I hope to engage. I mean, one of the things I want to do, and I said this on Stephanopoulos, which I want to engage the debate. I mean, I think this is an important debate. This is what I write in this book is what every American, who's concerned about the future of our country talks about at their kitchen table. I mean, I haven't left any stone unturned here about what, you know, whether it's the culture, whether it's, moral values, whether it's our education system, whether it's our society and how we interact with each other, whether it's our economy and what we've done as I mentioned in the book, to help the poor in particular. All of those things are things that we talk about, and we need to have a more frank discussion, and we need to understand the direction this country is going. Much of it is going in the right direction, and I'm an optimist, but there are some things that we need to address, and we need to change, and we need to refocus.
I was reading your interview with Human Events,
yeah,
and you said you build a strong America by having strong families, but also strong communities, churches,
right,
civic organizations,
yep,
philanthropic organizations.
The real village.
Because it teaches you to be selfless and connected to the world.
Right.
So you're saying the world, the real village, but you're also saying it takes a village, not just a family.
Well, I am, but I'm talking about the real village, and the real village is the community, is the neighborhood, is the church, is the local community around the individual who actually knows the name of the people in the community, actually identifies this person. And what I see as the village of the left is not the real village. It is the government. It is the elite institution. It's the experts in the educational institutions of our society.
We'll continue in a minute with Senator Rick Santorum, his new book called It Takes a Family, a response to Senator Clinton's book It Takes a Village. We recorded our interview with Senator Santorum yesterday for air this morning. Among the other things still to come this morning, did you see the write-up in Thomas Friedman's column yesterday of an otherwise obscure candidate for New York City public advocate proposing citywide wireless internet access? We will talk to that candidate later this hour. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer, WNYC. My guest is Rick Santorum, Republican Senator from Pennsylvania. His new book, It Takes a Family, a response to Hillary Clinton's book, It Takes a Village. We taped this yesterday, and so no phone calls during it, but we'll have a few minutes probably for phone calls afterwards. So if you want to react to anything Senator Rick Santorum has been saying, call now and get in line at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. When we left off before the break, we were talking about his definition of the village as compared to Senator Clinton's definition. I'm guessing that Senator Clinton would say, of course it's churches, of course it's civic organizations, of course it's philanthropic organizations, of course those are all real community, but so are the public schools, so is the government, which is the expression of the democracy that we all cherish in our country.
It's the question is who trumps whom? And I would argue that we should have policy directed at giving power to the family and local communities and getting it away from these higher levels. And what the left would say is that no, that these higher institutions are fairer. They're more just, they're more equitable, they're more democratic, and they reflect the broader vision of society, which should be the vision that we should have in this country. Again, I'm not saying that's not a legitimate point of view. I'm not saying that she shouldn't and have a place in the public square, and this shouldn't be a good debate. All I'm saying is that, you know, it's a debate we should have because it is a very different vision for America, and the result of who, in fact, you know, worldview predominates has a real impact on the future of America.
You've said that the left wants to destroy the family to create radical individualism. What does that radical individualism look like?
Yeah, it goes back to what I see as the left's view of freedom versus the right's view of freedom. And I say the right, I don't mean all on the right. I think that there's a lot on the right who actually share the left view of freedom. And I take issue with many on the right on this point.
Mm-hmm.
But I see the right's view of freedom is what I would say is traditionally oriented, traditional freedom as our founders understood it, which is a freedom with responsibility to something beyond yourself, a freedom that to do not what you want to do, not simply choice, but the freedom to do what you ought to do. And I would argue that the freedom on the left has been devolved down to a word, choice. That choice is the free is an autonomy. Personal autonomy is really the rule of how the left understands the view of freedom. And I use a quote throughout the book, which some of your listeners may be familiar with, which I think is sort of the motto, if you will, of the understanding of liberty by the left, and it comes from the United States Supreme Court, and I'll quote it.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, our obligation is to define the liberty of all, not to mandate our own moral code. Quote, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. That comes from Planned Parenthood v. Casey. It is the liberal view of freedom.
And what's wrong with that?
I have the right to define my own concept of existence, of what's right and what's wrong. It is personal autonomy, and it is not how societies function well.
Why isn't that a form of religious liberty? Again, something we value in this country.
Again, I have no problem if people want to hold that view, and I have no problem if they want to bring that view to the public square. I just would make the argument that I don't think that that's a healthy view of freedom.
Would you read it again? I'd like to hear let our listeners and let myself hear it again and digest it. Would you read that again?
It's from the 1992 Supreme Court decision on Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Quote, our obligation is to define the liberty of all, not to mandate our own moral code. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life, end quote.
And so what liberals might say to you with respect to some of your agenda and your reaction to that quote is that it looks like you want to impose your religion on them, that abortion has a lot to do with religious ideas about when – let me finish the question. Religious ideas about when personhood begins, homosexual marriage is condoned by some mainstream Christian denominations, not by others. So who is one religious group to say their religion has to be the law of the state?
you don't think that people going around doing whatever they think is right is imposing a moral view on me? Of course it is.
Only if it affects
a different moral view. This idea that somehow or another that people doing whatever they want to do and people defining their own concept of existence is not a moral viewpoint? Of course it's a moral viewpoint. It's a radically secular one. It is one that does not respect a common virtues and values that communities should share and should uphold. But don't try to play off to me that there is no moral point of view being expressed in that. It is a decisively moral point of view. It's one that I don't agree with. It's one that has a right to be argued in the public square, just like I have a right to argue my moral worldview in the public square, and let the democratic institutions, not the courts, make the decision as to which direction we take.
Senator Rick Santorum, my guest for just another few minutes on WNYC, his new book, It Takes a Family. So the gay rights groups, for example, would say, well, if we want to marry each other, that doesn't have anything to do with you. Why would you argue that it does?
Well,
how does it affect you?
Yeah, it affects me because it redefines the definition of marriage and therefore affects my marriage, because my marriage is defined by how society defines marriage. And if marriage is defined as it would be in the case of changing the definition of marriage to include a broader circle of people other than one man, one woman in a marriage relationship, if it changes that definition, then marriage becomes something different than what it is today. See, marriage and the purpose of marriage that every culture and every civilization known to man has had, not just religious one, but those that were animist, had in fact a ceremony or ritual in which one man and one woman would be held out as something unique and very important to the civilization. Why? Because the point of marriage from a societal point of view is not to affirm the love of two people and make people feel good about who they are in their relationship. But in fact, the point of marriage is for having children and raising that children in the best environment possible, in the most secure environment possible, and where one man and one woman bring unique gifts to the marriage, because men and women are different. They bring unique gifts to the marriage to be able to raise that child in the optimal place.
But
when we change that, we devalue the institution and we change it and reorient it more toward parents and away from children.
But isn't that an abstraction, and it still doesn't affect you in your marriage in the way you want it to be?
Of course it's not an abstraction, because everyone will be taught that marriage is not about children. That's very real. In fact, I would make the argument, and a lot of people who support same-sex marriages have come to me and said, well, you know, marriage is already about adults. I mean, we've seen with no-fault divorce and the divorce culture, again brought to us by the left, that marriage is more about adults than it is about children.
What about all the heteros?
And I would say I agree with you, that marriage has devolved into being more about adults than more about children. I think that's wrong, too, and I think we need to reorient marriage to be more child-focused as opposed to parent-focused.
So all the heterosexual married couples choosing not to have kids today more than ever before, you would say what to them?
It's the exception rather than the rule, and what society should be focused on is the rule and the ideal. And the ideal, I believe one of the great reasons for laws is to make sure that society continues and continues in a healthy way. That means we need to set up institutions where we try to strive for the ideal, not necessarily requiring everyone to achieve that ideal, but we should have the ideal in place to give children the best chance for a healthy life.
It came out this month that your communications director, Robert Trainum, is gay. How long did you know that?
I've known it for a while.
And if he has a boyfriend, is that the moral equivalent, as in a famous quote of yours, of bigamy, adultery, or incest, or even bestiality?
Well, number one, my famous quote did not draw moral equivalence. And in fact, if you read the quote in its proper context, without words inserted by a reporter who put words in my mouth that I did not say, nor did I mean.
Can I read the quote and you tell me how accurate this version of it is from the AP?
Go ahead.
If the Supreme Court says that you have the right to consensual sex within your home, and there the reporter inserted the word gay in parentheses.
Which I did not say.
Okay.
And let me explain before you go on.
Okay.
What the court was saying is that if you have the right to consensual sexual activities, then what I was doing there is quoting the Bowers decision and Justice White's opinion in the Bowers decision, which was the previous case to the Lawrence case. And basically what Justice White said is that we can't grant consensual sexual activity to one form of sexual activity and somehow draw an artificial line against other forms of sexual activity. That's what I said. That's what the quote was centered around. It was a legal argument where I simply was repeating what Justice White had said in the Supreme Court case 12 or 13 years prior, and I might add, it's almost exactly what Justice Scalia said in the dissent in the Lawrence v. Texas case.
This is in the sodomy case. So the full quote, your actual quote without any words inserted,
yeah.
If the Supreme Court says that you have the right to consensual sex within your home, then you have the right to bigamy, you have the right to polygamy, you have the right to incest, you have the right to adultery, you have the right to anything.
Right.
And the gay rights groups would say, no, because all of those other things have victims. And so the consensual sex that is gay sex is just not in the same category as incest or adultery or bigamy.
I respect their argument. I disagree with it. And I think when you say that consensual sexual activity, you have a much harder time. And by the way, Justice Scalia feels this way. Justice White felt this way. And other courts along the line whether they were the circuit courts and other courts that were dealing with this case, basically said virtually the same things I say, that once you open up that window beyond, what originally was, be honest with you, what was originally sex with inside marriage, once you open that door, and it now instead of that the Supreme Court was protecting sexual activities within marriage, once you sort of take marriage away and say it's now just consent, you open up a door that I think is going to be very hard to close to other activities. And in fact, you see polygamists who are now filing suit in a variety of courts across the country asking for the same rights that the Lawrence decision has given to same-sex couples.
By the way, do you have lively debates with your press secretary over this? Does he try to convince you? Did you try to convince him to go get cured?
No, his personal life is his personal life. I don't have lively debates with any of my staff about their personal life. It's their personal life, and I have lively debates about issues of public policy, and I have people on my staff that agree with me on everything, and well, not everything, but most everything, and I have those who don't. And, that makes for a healthy debate within the office.
So as we finish up here, I appreciate you engaging in lively debate in the way you do. You've come on with us several times on this program, and I'm just curious, because you also have the reputation of being the person who's going out there on President Bush's Social Security reform.
Yeah.
And having the real town meetings, having people come all over Pennsylvania,
yeah,
who are willing to disagree with you. And I wonder if you, and while he's having these sort of, if you don't mind me saying it, fake town meetings with staged with supporters, do you wish the president was going out and doing what you do?
Every person has to do it differently. And when you're the president and you've got all the security concerns that a president has, and you have a Secret Service that worries about everything, they candidly, a lot of the president's events are driven by security concerns, to be very honest with you, as opposed to, mine, which, are very open. And, my feeling is that I'm not the president. I don't have the security concerns that presidents have, and I just left a town meeting where I had about 400 people asking me questions just a few minutes ago. I think it's good. I think it's good, healthy debate. I know that when I walk into a room or when I call a radio show, there's going to be people who don't agree with me. But hopefully, I'm respectful of their opinions, and hopefully they'll be respectful of mine.
Senator Rick Santorum, his new book, It Takes a Family, published by ISI. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We recorded that interview yesterday with Senator Santorum, and we have 4 minutes right now for some quick reactions from you before our next guests are coming in. Trish in Jersey City, you're on WNYC.
Hi. I just want to say Mr. Santorum has been exercising doublespeak extraordinaire. He's the only person I know who can take historical movement language and spin it 180 degrees, like in 30 seconds. The idea that it's a conservative idea that women's work should be valued is hysterical. The idea that rugged individualism is a liberal idea is outrageous. Just from a historical point of view, if you think about social history, do I have to say more?
No, you don't. Trish, thank you. Leroy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. I was so glad to hear this, hear Santorum himself. I remember when he made that statement that you quoted about the Texas sodomy case, and he was pilloried and lambasted and all of that. And it's so interesting that, in fact, he was absolutely right, and you and I had a colloquy about that, and I pointed out he was right. Then later on, the pastor from Riverside Church came to your program, and I called in and asked him that question. He completely avoided it. Then you went back and asked him again, and he completely avoided it. Rick Santorum pointed out that if you're in favor of homosexual marriage, logically you have to be in favor of incestuous marriage, you have to be in favor of polygamous marriage. What the liberals don't want to do is face the consequences of their choices.
Leroy, thank you. Steve in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Hi.
Hi.
I agree with Trish, and I'd like to say what I saw him doing was trying to accomplish the buzzwords of several strains of the Republican Party at once. So he was trying to incorporate the freedom theme with the less taxes theme, with the strong families theme. And because he's a Northeast Republican, I really don't think he knew what any of those meant. So trying to turn the family strong traditional values theme into a freedom thing simultaneously is what got him into those thickets of rhetoric. And frankly, I feel bad for him, honestly, because it just shows the soullessness of the Republican Party right now. I mean, and I got that. It was very convoluted, don't you think?
I'm going to leave your comments okay. there. And Glenn on Staten Island, you're on WNYC.
Yes, hi, Brian. Thanks for calling the call. I'm calling in basically as a stay-at-home dad of a 7-year-old son.
All right.
I actually stayed home with him since we adopted him from Korea at an early age. A couple of things about the Santorum interview. I have no particular problem with the idea that we should be encouraging one parent or the other to stay at home more with kids, but of course certain things have to be done for that. The first being that parents do need the money. I do not really agree with his tax analysis. I agree more with yours that basically the burden of tax has shifted from the rich to the middle class, and I think that people need to go out and work, and that is why they are actually working. Second of all, while I think most people would prefer some sort of part-time work, the reason a lot of them have to go full-time is for benefits. Another third rail in American politics besides Social Security is universal health care. I would think that if, to take to the logical extreme, if we followed what Senator Santorum would want, we would have to institute some sort of system such as in the Nordic countries, where people who do stay at home and raise children not only have health care, of course, but are stipended to do so. And I have a feeling that Senator Santorum and a lot of the rest of the party would see that as some sort of socialist intervention.
Glenn, thank you. And Lisa in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm also conservative, but I'm Jewish, and I would have a big problem with having Senator Santorum impose his moral values, which I assume are Christian, and I assume that most of the right assumes that.
We have 30 seconds left in the segment. Tell me a specific example, if you can, of how his conservative Christian moral values would differ from your conservative Jewish moral values.
Well, not specific values, but when he had a problem with the Supreme Court giving every individual the right to assume his own morals and his own meaning in life, I assume that a lot of conservative Muslims and conservative other religions would have a problem with that. I mean, we have a different idea of the meaning of life than I'm sure a lot of Christians do, and I think the liberals have given every religion a right to practice their own belief and their own way of life very freely.
And Lisa, that has to be the last word. Thanks to you. Thanks to all of you who called. Thanks again to Senator Santorum. Maybe we'll pick up that quote again for a longer call-in, his quote from the Supreme Court decision on personal autonomy. But that's it for this call-in. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.